Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. We come your way on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Mondays at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we link to our guests. And we're going to be giving you the website for our guest here in just a few moments. Just want to let you know that here we are in our 10th year of doing these programs and, quite honestly, heading towards 40 years of interviewing. And it's just extraordinary, the people that I have come across, the conversations we have had. And, I can't thank all of my guests over and literally thousands of people that I've talked with in the last 40 years, let alone the hundreds and hundreds that I've talked with in the last 10. And it's just extraordinary, the information that's available. And you can get that information by going to the website, richarddugan.com. And you can either go to the schedules page. You can see who's coming up, And then you can go to the archives page or the radio shows page, and you can listen to the interviews. Also, a reminder that some of these interviews run much longer than just the standard radio broadcast time, which is usually about 50 minutes with a 4-minute commercial break in the middle. But sometimes we go on for another 10, 15, 20, if I'm lucky to keep the guest on that long, 30 minutes beyond, and continue the conversation, because there's always so much more to talk about. And there's a lot to talk about with our guest today. He's very prolific in his in the information that he's putting out, and we're going to be talking, I think, with an extraordinary gentleman who's had some very, very interesting experiences, and we're going to talk about that. And my guest name is Peter Baldwin Panagor. I want to welcome you to our program via Skype. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Hi,
everybody.
indeed. It's interesting in the times in which we live. I've been hearing more and more in the last 2.5-3 years. Just remember that old Chinese proverb, we live in interesting times. Well, I don't think there's a time in history that it hasn't been interesting, depending upon what's going on. Oof. And here we are in the 21st century. We still don't have those damn flying cars that I was really hoping for watching the Jetsons as a kid in the 60s. Folks, that's the 1960s. And yet you have written a series of books, which I've often found very intriguing. Heaven is Beautiful, How Dying Caught Me. Taught me that death is just the beginning. You've also got other books, 2 Minutes for God, Quick Fixes for the Spirit. You also have Chicken Soup for the Vet's Soul, as well as Stories from a Soldier's Heart. And we're going to focus predominantly on this whole aspect of death and transitioning, as I like to call it. I have to share with you, too, that and I'm not sure if you're familiar with what's called LBL, Life Between Lives, from the Newton Institute. Dr. Newton did a great deal of research, and he's written about it in his books. He has since passed, Destiny of the Soul and Journey of the Soul, dealing with that space between reincarnations. Because apparently there's still stuff going on. They're still learning. They're still growing. They're still resting and those kinds of things. And as a matter of fact, the more I think about what he talked about, the more I'm thinking, I can hardly wait to transition because I'll get some rest, because we're not getting much these days because life is just moving along. Heaven is Beautiful. You have experienced near-death experiences. You've had near-death experiences, correct?
Yes, sir.
Tell me about the first one.
Well, in the first one, I was a 21-year-old in 1980 ice climbing in British Columbia and Alberta, north of Banff and then Banff National Park. And I made a foolish mistake that compounded into a desperate situation where we were stuck on our climb through the night with severely dropping temperatures, wet to the skin, having consumed our food, with no chance of fire. And hypothermia onset early in the evening, just after sunset, and continued through almost to dawn the next day as we fought our way down the mountain. And on our last rappel, I fell asleep and crossed over and was allowed to come back.
Did you want to come back?
Yes, okay. I did. I wanted to come back because my sister had vanished when I was a kid, when I was 14, and that's what we saw. But really what happened was she ran away, but we didn't know for a long time, and things compounded over the years. And I was on the run from my family's emotions, and my parents were wounded, and it felt like my mom had lost a child, and even though by then we knew that she was not missing so much as vanished from us. But it broke my mom, and so when I was dead. Let me pick up at the point where I died.
Okay.
It will make more sense. So I was with my partner, Tim, about 150 feet up on our last, at the top of our last rappel. And we were once again stuck and unable to move. And we'd been there for 3 hours or so. And hypothermia had advanced to me getting warm, and we'd already gone through the stages and we're still in of mental confusion and loss of coordination, frostbite on digits and feet. And I got warm and I unzipped my coat, and that's, you know, not what you do, but that's what the brain told me to do because I felt like I was hot. And my partner, Tim, said, "Don't unzip your coat." And I said, "What difference does it make? You know, we're not getting off of here." And I began to pray and think about my family and my mom and my dad. And I then began to fall asleep. And I was on a harness clipped into the mountain. And so when I would fall asleep, I'd slump and fall off the ledge and get caught on the harness and pull myself back up. And that happened a bunch of times. And then this one time it happened, and I pulled myself back up, and I stood there with my face basically touching the rock in front of me. We were off the ice at this point on granite, and my face was pretty close to the rock, and I suddenly saw my peripheral vision become black like a circle, like the end of a Porky Pig cartoon, and it began to crush in on me, and my vision narrowed and became more and more narrow, and I shifted my head and I looked off to the sky. I could see the stars and the glaciers, and watched the circle get closer and closer. And I swung over to the right and I looked to the right and I watched it just go black right in front of me. And I felt myself fall, and I thought to myself, I'm not asleep. I still have consciousness. I'm falling. And then I waited to hit the mountain, as I did every single time I fell asleep, and that's what would wake me up. I'd smack into the mountain. And this time I didn't feel that. And I thought, what is this? And then my whole entire interior horizon opened in front of me into this onrushing entity of consciousness that was communicating to me directly that it was taking me. And it filled my entire vision and rushed toward me. And I became defensive and frightened and put up my barrier. I had spent all night digging ever deeper inside myself in order to drive myself onward. And so I had all this willpower of survival that I put in front of me, and it just was nothing. It just, and this being, entity, angel of death plucked me and took me like I was made of feather, and brought me into this, what some mystics call the valley of love, or the outer darkness that's illuminated, where I had no being other than my consciousness. I had no physicality at all. I had no brain and no eyes and no hands. I was an orb of energetic consciousness, of beingness, but not like beingness like I'd ever encountered before. It was of another order and another place where there is no time and there is no space. So there's no sequence of events and there's no English language. There was only being. And in this space, I could see in every direction at once, as if I was at one eyeball or I had 10,000 eyeballs. I couldn't really tell. And then appeared in front of me like a passageway, a doorway, like a portal. And it was gigantic in this place where there were no size. And I, because there's no space, so there's no measurements. And I saw through this transparent and translucent surface an arc way, like a tunnel going into infinity. And I touched the surface of this gateway with my being, and it was living and electric and flowing with life and love, and it was alive. And as I did that, I heard my name called from outside myself, but inside my being, I knew that my name was called by the one who made me and knew me and created me and made me from everlasting, a being, the being that I was. And yet somehow there was these, there, even though there was a continuity to my beingness, there were somehow like, I don't know how to describe it yet, like, I don't want to say doorways, but like multiple lives all at once. It wasn't like there was, because it's timeless, I still don't understand it. All I knew is that I knew that I was myself, and then I was created from everlasting, and I was completely known, and there was nothing about me that was hidden whatsoever. And I knew also simultaneously that I was completely in the presence of the infinite, eternal, divine, and I was in awe. And in being known by the knower, I experienced all the pain that I'd caused everyone in my entire life, because there's nothing about me that was hidden. And I suffered all of the pain that I had given intentionally and unintentionally to everyone from their point of view, times 10,000 their emotions. And it was awful and suffering, and but shameful. I was shamed at myself for having wounded others, not because I had done anything other than I could have done, but because I was in the utter presence of divine light that was so illuminated that I was ashamed of my actions, my being, my what I had done. And the voice of the divine said inside of me without language, I love you. I made you. I know you. I've always known you. I'm your maker. I know everything about you. I love you. I forgive you. I forgive you. Mm. And then I was infilled with this combination of like truth, love, beauty, compassion, joy, knowledge, and so much love and beauty and overflowing. And I knew that I had changed. And so I said inside myself without language, am I dead? And the voice said, yes, you're dead. And I knew that I was in the presence of God because it was self-evident to me. And still in the state of awe of the infinitude of the divine being was far beyond my vision. But yet I could see so much, but what I could see was nothing compared to the infinite nature of the eternal. Mm. I could only, but it was overwhelming and all filling with this combination of these things here that we separate with language. You know, truth is one thing, faith is another, hope's a third thing. Not like that at all. All wound into one beautiful being of love, infilled inside me. And I said, am I dead? And the voice said, yes, you're dead. And I said, well, I can't die now. And the voice said, why? And I said, because my sister's missing. And in an instant, at a thought, I was swept with the voice and the divine being to see all of Earth simultaneously, every human being on Earth, all at once. And I could see all of them with a veil on them. And the veil isn't like a burqa, or it was the divine existence of this entire world that we're in, from the Big Bang to the current state of our time. It's no one here can see what I could see because of the structure of the world itself. And God said to me, in the way that you now know that I have always loved you, I always will love you, and I do love you in that way that you know that love, which was felt to me to be infinite, but it wasn't. It was just more than I'd ever experienced or could hear. And I love every single person that way, but they can't see it. And I love your parents that way. And because of my love, you now know that no matter what happens in life, all will be well. And I could see that all sin that I had caused in my life was of the same level. And God said, you are made this way. You are made in this world of brokenness that you can't help but hurt other people and suffer because you're inside this world. But my love is so much greater than this world that my love is so great that all will be well eternally for you and for all. Mm. And you now know this. And I could see my parents' faces in particular and their suffering right then. Like not just the skin of their and the bone of their faces, but like the essence of their soul suffering. And I knew that they would be well when they died. But I then also knew that they were still in the world. I could see that they were in the world, and I could see that they were going to live a long time and then suffer the loss of two children. And it had broken my mother. My mother was healed, and she's healed now as well as she can be, but it was pretty bad. Mm. And so I then said, and I have another reason why. And God said, what's that? I said, well, I'm in this theater company and we're leaving on this national tour and we've been in rehearsal and I made a promise. I made a promise that I wouldn't get hurt. And here I am. I'm dead. I'm not just hurt. And God said, nothing. And I said, if I go back, can I come back here? And God said, yes, you can come back here if you want to go back. I said, well, do I have to stay here? And God said, no, you don't have to stay here. And I said, well, then I choose to live my life. And God said, you won't live your life. And the next thing I knew, I was being screwed painfully, like shoved like a huge styrofoam ball getting crushed down into fit inside this little tiny peanut that didn't fit well, and it hurt to go back in. And when I began to come to the surface of my physical body, I was lost and confused. And I heard noises that I couldn't make sense of. And I didn't know where I was in space. And I didn't understand harnesses or rocks or ice. And after a while, I kind of came up and my partner pulled me up and said, as I became clear, I don't know how long this took, that I kind of could stand and look at him and understand that he was a human being, even though I didn't have any idea what I was. Mm-hmm. And he said, you were dead. You were dead. I thought you were dead. If you died, I was going to die. Mm. And then after more time passes, he begins to instruct me, you know, pull the rope again. I pulled the rope and the rope came free. It had been stuck the whole time up in this dark crag above us, 100 feet. Irretrievable in the dark, irretrievable in the daylight without another rope. And we descended. Hmm. And then I kept my mouth shut for 20 years. Because it was, I had no idea what happened to me.
Yeah.
There was no context for me.
That's what's interesting about descriptions that I've heard too. And I went through one of these, as I shared earlier, this LBL experience. It's they take you into through hypnosis, and you're conscious. And I was fully conscious of what was happening and what I was saying. Mm-hmm. But I was asked, so what do you see? What do you hear? What do you taste, smell, et cetera, the basic five senses experience. And I said, nothing. I'm aware of, but I don't sense in that context. And when I think about, for example, telepathy, there are no words used. I think that telepathy is more sharing awareness, sharing images maybe, at the very least, because words just, they're so incomplete. They're so, they get in the way. And so when you and I, we stand and we watch a sunset, even though we both have a different experience through our individual eyes, we both can share that moment and we both understand, wow, just wow, you know? I'm curious about where you come from. You mentioned your mother. I'm curious about your upbringing spiritually. Where were you coming from at that point? Because I'm wondering how much that influenced your waiting 20 years before you started talking about this.
Oh, well, it didn't really influence my decision not to talk about it, because I chose not to talk about it because it was crazy, Richard.
Okay.
It was 1980, and I had never heard of it. And then I left on this theater tour for 6 months, and I didn't have any access to any libraries, and I couldn't talk to my friends in the company. I couldn't talk to anybody about it, and I thought it was crazy. I felt like I was living in this two-dimensional world, having visited the real three-dimensional world, and here I am stuck back in this black and white, flat, two-dimensional space that I don't fit in anymore. And I've got one eye staring off into the heaven all the time. I'm always hearing the call of my name way down deep inside me. Never, ever, ever does it ever go away. And I was alone in that. But my upbringing did help me deal with it.
Okay.
And I did that internally because In brief, I was raised in two Christian churches, Greek Orthodox and Roman Catholic.
Mm.
Mom's Roman Catholic, dad's GO, went to Catholic high school. When I was in high school, I went to my senior year of high school, we took one religion class a year, reading all the Gospels. And so at the end of the year, we finished the Gospel of John. Our teacher goes off to this local monastery. It's a Trappist monastery, St. Joseph's Abbey, where they sell jellies and jams to make a living. But they've been studying with Sasaki Roshi for about a decade, trying to reinvigorate their contemplative experience of practice of prayer. And my teacher went into a retreat, and he learned how to meditate. And he came back to class that Monday or Tuesday, whatever it was, and he taught us to meditate, and I became an adherent right then and there. And I could do it. And so I had been practicing. So then I went off and went to UMass Amherst and studied English and had an affinity for the Romantics and the more prayerful side of the Transcendentalists and the mystics. And so I started reading kind of broadly Emerson and Thoreau and Melville, and then it kind of led me to the Vedas and often the Tao Te Ching and those sorts of things. And then I went out west. Last thing is I became a Catholic charismatic kind of Pentecostal, born again, slain in the spirit kind of Christian when I was, how old was I? I was probably freshman year of college, and went with this group called Teens Encounter Christ in the Catholic Church on the East Coast, and did a lot of kind of praying. And I was a backslider by the time I was on this mountain. But after I came back, I went back to UMass. I was on exchange. I was an exchange student at Montana State University in Bozeman. And I went back to UMass, and I took a class in the comparative English department, comparative literature department. And it was a study of mysticism East and West. From anthologies with some specific readings as we went along. And that professor took us on a Zazen retreat at the same monastery. When I was at this monastery, beginning my mystical explorations, I met this monk who was the novitiate master who radiated out his eyes. I could see the light coming out of his eyes like laser beams, and his just presence was illuminated. And my buddy asked him, "What's it like to be you?" And he said, "I was asleep, now I am awake." And I thought to myself, this man can help me. This is the same monastery where they... So I began going there on retreat a lot and trying to talk to this monk about my mystical experiences. By then, by this point, I'd begun to have these other out-of-body experiences. I even had a couple before I had my NDE that turned out to be sort of, well, they were warnings to what was to come. And so I then toyed with the idea of being a monk, because the contemplative interior life, it turns out the interior world is much vaster than the exterior world, because the interior world gives you access to the divine. And the exterior world, God is immanent. God is in all things, all the time, everywhere. But the interior world, inside ourselves, is where we can access the transcendent. And that became my devotion and my practice. And I ended up not going to the monastery because I wanted to have sex. And I'm heterosexual. And so I went to Yale Divinity School to get a master's in divinity with a specialty, a focus on the history of Christian mysticism with a smattering of Eastern Western stuff, and studied systematics and analytics and theology, but mostly mysticism. And so picked up yoga along the way back at UMass, kind of a practicer of combination of Kundalini and Iyengar and Hatha with some of the Paramahansa Yogananda. He's out your way, or mm-hmm. it was anyway, the mm-hmm. Self-Realization Fellowship. His book had a very specific impact on me before and after this experience, to be able to use yoga as a divine practice of prayer. So I integrated my meditation into my yoga practice and began practicing the focusing on my breath and my form to and moving my chi, or my prana, to up and down my chakras and out my arms and legs, in order to open up a channel to make myself less, in order to have more space for the light to be infilling. And that's been my goal and my practice and my dedication my whole life, because I just want to go home. Almost 2 years ago now, a year and a half ago, I had a heart attack. I was fit. I was like at yoga class. I'd run 5K the day before, taking care of myself, got heart attacks in the family, and I still had one, and 100% blockage in my widowmaker. I live in a rural place, an hour from the major hospital, and Sunday traffic. I live in like in a resort area in Maine, and so bumper to bumper, and on the way, I can't take opiates because I'm allergic to them, so I was meditating through my pain all the way to the hospital. They gave me I had a 3% trickle through by that point. They gave me a shot, but I can't take any opiates. And so I meditated, separating myself from my pain. And as I was meditating, you still hear what's going on around you when you're doing that. And I heard the paramedics say, to the hospital, "We're having trouble keeping him alive," essentially. "Now, what should we do?" So as she said that, I looked at her. And she was like, "Oh my God, he's awake!" And I closed my eyes, and they adjusted something. But as I closed my eyes and went back through to my meditation, my entire horizon was once more filled with the same angel of death, but this time was gentle and inviting, and I kind of passed underneath it, and as I looked at it, I was welcomed back and in, and found myself going. And I thought to myself that I'd been telling my wife for 30 years, ever since I told her. And she was the only one I told her on the night before our wedding eve, that I was praying for my own death. Mm. And I've been praying for my own death since then. So here it was, my first opportunity to go home again. And yet I thought to myself, wait a minute, before I go, if I can go, I'll go. But let me think about it first. Let me make a good choice. And so I went back into my meditation and I thought to myself about what my son did to me as I got loaded on the gurney at the urgent care. He was living in town for that summer and he's 24 now. And he came over and he grabbed my hand and he squeezed it. He came in really close, looked me in the eyes and said, "I love you, Dad." And so I'm thinking about that. And I'm thinking about his sister, my daughter, who's just had a baby and the marriage is destroyed because the poor fellow went off to war. He went to Afghanistan and got promoted and things terrible happened to him. And it destroyed him. Maybe he's salvageable. We hope so. But for now, it's not good. And so she had just moved home with the grandbaby. And I thought about the grandbaby. And I decided to take another look. And so I glanced back out of my meditation. And there was death waiting for me, having receded some distance. And as I looked, came and welcomed me again. And I just turned my inner eye back to my family and the love that I had here. The people needed me. And so, you know, I get to the hospital, they put in a stent. My son comes to visit and he says to me, "Dad, the doc told me to say goodbye to you because nobody thought you were going to make it."
Mm. Wow.
So twice now, wow. Twice. And the thing I really want to say to everybody is this, is that God is love. And that our commodity here, the thing that matters most here, is love. I came back twice for love. I don't really want to be here, but love is a binder here. It's the thing we give away that is our treasure. The more we give it away, the more it accrues to us. The more we accept it from other people, the more it accrues to us. There's an endless well of love. It never runs out. It never runs dry. That's what I have to say is love your neighbor as yourself and love God above all things, all things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Fascinating story, no question about it. Heaven is Beautiful is the title of the work that we're sort of discussing now, How Dying Taught Me That Death is Just the Beginning. And we are very grateful for Peter Panagor sharing this time with us. We're going to continue on this program here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. I ask you to stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Oh, like many families, my family had our share of trouble. I was in Montana to escape it. I'd picked Bozeman because it was far away from Massachusetts and our family crisis, which had dragged on for decades. It started when my sister Andrea was a child, and she accidentally hung herself by her cowgirl hat while bouncing on her bed. Our mother had told her not to bounce on the bed, but she did. Our mom was in another
This is
room.
Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. You do have the right channel, the right station, the right audio file. And I'm Richard Dugan, your host. That is from the audiobook, Heaven is Beautiful. Peter Panagor is my guest. And again, Peter, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. That is one of the aspects that I promote in a big way is Audible books. And I even produce them myself. And it's exciting to be able to put that into my phone, into my tablet, and plug the earbuds in and take my walks and just listen to extraordinary stories. And in this case, yours, Heaven is Beautiful, How Dying Taught Me That Death is Just the Beginning. I'm curious as to how your life changed, not just, I mean, you've given us incredible description thus far. But how it was transformed in terms of the direction that you wound up in. It's, I guess the question is, what is it that you wanted it to be when you grew up in the early days, your single and maybe teen years, versus today?
Well, there were two things. When I was in high school, I wanted to join either the U.S. Navy or the United States Coast Guard as an officer. And so I worked very hard all the way through high school to become a congressional appointee to one of the academies. And I won a congressional appointee to appointment to the Coast Guard Academy. But that summer I declined it, and my parents freaked out, and my dad got me into UMass. And so first I wanted to be an officer. And then when I was at UMass, my dad was an architect, and he had been president of the Massachusetts Association of Architects and been slated to be the national president the year that he had his heart attack at the same age I was, 56. You know, there you go. And he had a firm outside of Boston, and I'd been pushing pencils for him all my life, and I could draw, and I could think conceptually, and I'd been working as a laborer for a contractor for 5 years. I could swing a hammer and talk to the blue-collar guys and swear and drink beer. And then my sister went off and got a graduate degree in architecture, and that's what I was going to do too. And we were going to be the family firm. And but after this event, everything changed. I came home. So I stayed in Montana, and then I went on this national theater tour. It was a college tour. Mm-hmm. And then I hitchhiked back east with a buddy of mine from Bozeman to Boston. And when I got home, I was a different guy. I was quieter than I was. I was already quiet, but I was super quiet. And it was years later, this past summer, actually, I was talking to my dad on Cape Cod. And my dad, who's in his 80s, said, "Peter, we knew that you had changed, but we didn't know why or how." He said, you were suddenly compassionate and civil and kind and respectful and caring. And not that you weren't before, but it was different. Your mother and I, he said, used to talk about it. And I couldn't ever not see the light that surrounds me, that is me, that's way beyond me. And that was the most frightening an attractive thing I'd ever encountered. So I went off to divinity school instead. And when I was there, still practicing yoga and meditation and reading in the great mystic geniuses of Christianity, of which there are many, but they're books that are hidden away and kept aside. And you know, I read all the non-canonical texts too. But it's the mystical writers that hold the keys to the doorways, and it's not just the Christians, the Muslims. There are Sufi writers who know the divine self because the door has been opened on their inside, and that's what I pursued. That's how my life changed. I left the world that I expected to dwell in and found myself with a master's degree and no idea what I was going to do with it, and was invited to, convinced to try ordination in the United Church of Christ and become a church pastor. And I thought to myself, well, think about Wordsworth and Blake and those romantics who all went to divinity school and Emerson and Thoreau. And what did they do? They wrote. So what if I could spend my life in prayer, working in community, and practicing writing under the guise of being a preacher, a community leader, a pastor? And so that's what I picked, and that's what I did. And the problem with me doing that, from my interior perspective, is that one of the things that came about as my near-death experience is that I had all my faith taken away from me. All of my faith was gone, and all of my belief was gone. And not just my belief in the ideas about God, but my belief in culture and nationhood and all these things that are so human constructed that aren't the change from time to time over generations, over countries, over languages and cultures. Those things are wonderful because they're diverse and fun, but they're ultimately artificial, and there's only one real. And I felt so attached to this one real that my entire profession became focused on that. And so, well, last thing I want to say, because I forgot to, is that I also had all my doubt taken away from me. I don't have any doubt. I know that I'm known, and I can't say it more accurately than that, even though that's not quite accurate. I just know that God is always present. It's not like I believe in God. That's gone.
Mm. I was interviewing a gentleman who also had a death experience. In the interview, he said that he was not aware of anything. One moment he was there, he had a heart attack, and the next moment he was back. And he has no recollection whatsoever. And so we're chatting away, and I said, we're here with so-and-so. He died and lived to tell about it. And that's what seems to happen with a lot of folks who it seems to be happening, or maybe it isn't that it's happening more. It's just that because of technology, we're hearing about it, such as your story, Peter. And it's extraordinary for me. I always struggle with phrasing it this way, that this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. No, I've never had an out-of-body, let alone a near-death experience, in spite of the fact that I remember after going through my first divorce, people would look at me and say, "You look so different," you know. Yeah. So I thought, oh, I reincarnated, but in the same lifetime, you know. But I've always envied those people. For example, when Michael Jackson passed away, and I was never really a huge fan, his music wasn't bad, but when he died, the first thing that went through my mind was, I wonder what he's experiencing. What is he doing? I mean, what's going on? And I've always wanted to go there and find out. But everybody's experience is so different. It's almost like, all right, I got to collect all these experiences. I got to get Peter's, and I got to get this person's and that person's, and I got to put them all together and cull out the similarities to even have an inkling of what's on the other side. Now, you said something very important, that you have no more doubt, but of a specific aspect of being, and that is, you have no doubt that you are known.
I have no doubt that I'm known, and I can't be unknown. I've always been known, and in my being known, I know that I'm beloved.
Yeah. I find it so fascinating. I myself was not only born and raised in the Western Rite of the Catholic Church, but in my first marriage, I was exposed to the Eastern Rite, Byzantine Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that.
Still under the Pope. Okay, a lot of people said, "Oh, it's Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox." No.
Mm-mm.
And I said, and the thing that was so extraordinary about it was the fact that it was and is filled with incredible aspects that I really enjoy are the ceremony, the pageantry, the traditions and rituals. I'm just so intrigued by them, not so much by the dogma and doctrine, but the fact that the faith is so willing to at least consider certain possibilities, and that the individuals, and I had this opportunity of speaking with a Monsignor of the Byzantine Rite, and I asked him some very pointed, what might be considered heretical questions that could get you in a lot of trouble in days gone by. And he was open and willing to answer the questions honestly that didn't necessarily conform to the church's teachings. In other words, these were conclusions he came to even as a member of the clergy. And I had to give the man a great deal of respect for his openness in that regard. He says, like, I know what the church teaches, but this is my experience, or this is what my musings tell me. So when we start talking about this process of death and dying, of near-death experiences, or even out of body, you know, I interviewed a fundamentalist evangelical Christian gentleman who even to this day is, yet he intentionally experiences and induces out-of-body experiences. And I said, well, okay, to play, no pun intended here, to play the devil's advocate, Where in the New Testament or even the Old Testament is that sanctioned? He says, nowhere. Well, who am I to question someone's experience? I can't challenge anything that you have said here. This is your experience. And it's not that I am challenging it or questioning it in that regard.
No, I hear you. I hear you.
People have
it's anecdotal.
Well, it is. But at the same time, there's so much that can be learned. And if we would just open ourselves up to it. And that's what this program's about, is putting these different ideas on the table and saying,
well,
consider.
I can say that I found on Facebook, I found a group called Near-Death Experiencers, and it's got like 17 or 18,000 people. And it's when I joined it 3 months ago, it was 11,000 people. So it's growing pretty rapidly.
Wow.
And I found in that crowd people like myself. And when it's a kind of a private place for, even though it's public, it's kind of an honest place where the near-death experiencers are asking the very same questions that you're asking. How can I have gone in some sort of hyper-vivid corporeal form into a land of like a garden, and you got transported through the cosmos, through the stars to a planet that had beings who were your pure spiritual group? And how was it that Peter, got placed in this place of non-being? The thing that we all are discussing is that, but the thing that we all find to be truth is that God is love, and that love is all that matters. That's the message that's coming back over and over and over again. And so I wonder about my experience. My experience is of a different level order. There seems to be, you know, my mom, when she was a kid, it turns out my mom had an NDE when she was a kid, but didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
She got a piece of popcorn stuck up on her gum when, like, 1945 or something, and they had to give her surgery, so they gave her gas, and out she pops out of her body in the surgical room and goes through the wall and sees her mother on a bench reading a book. And so there's that level where from that point on, you know that, except for my mom, everybody else knows that they're not their physical form. My mom knew it at a certain level, but she could never really admit it until recently. And so then there's the people who go into the tunnel and they meet Uncle Joe, and Uncle Joe says, go home. And there's people who go to hell and they go to the fire. I mean, I went through fire, but for me, it was cleansing. I couldn't go in without being cleansed, I guess. But the message, the compounded message that's coming back the most is God is love.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I was, and you know, you say you went through your seminary period, if you will. I did too. Of course, mine, I was 20 years old. When I first started working for a Christian radio station, that went on for 15 years. Best education I was ever paid for, I got to tell you.
I bet.
Thank God I have no student loans to pay back on that one. But it opened up my eyes to so many different things. But one of the things that really struck me over the course of this experience, I remember hearing quite often, you know, how lowly and vile and terrible and awful we were as human beings, you know, because of original sin. And then I remember hearing the reading of this particular passage in the New Testament about, you know, be ye perfect, even as your heaven and Father in heaven is perfect. So I started to dissect and try to define that word in that context. And I thought, well, no, wait a minute. You know, the Old Testament says, you know, I am that I am. Well, if God is perfect, then perfect can't be right, wrong, good, bad, light, dark, good, evil. Perfection has to be, and again, this is using even the Bible as its own dictionary, has to be just to be. So
yes.
To be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect is just to be, and no judgment of any kind. And then of course, I took that to the next level in terms of the low-level sermons that you'd hear about human beings. I thought, well, okay, if you want to accept the crucifixion story, then there's a problem with your lowly, vile, icky, terrible, disgusting human beings. And then this sacrifice. The only reason that God would have set up this sacrifice is because we had value, which meant we were important, we were precious from from as long as we've been known, as you've described.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no lowly, disgusting worms sludging through the mud and so forth. We are diamonds. We are jewels. We are precious beyond beyond belief. And that's why that was done. And so, when I put that all together, I'm going, okay, I can let that go now. I can breathe, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I can
mm-hmm.
move on to other things and experiences and so forth. And, speaking of experiences, you've described yours. I always found it rather sad that when people would call into many of the prayer programs or many of the Bible study programs on that station, they would sort of share their an experience that they had that wasn't really biblically supported, and it was then explained away. And I thought, oh my God, you're invalidating this human being and just their existence because you're invalidating one of these experiences. And that's one of the things that I've always stayed away from. Learn about it, try to understand it, but never invalidate, because that's part of who you are now and have been for over 20 years.
It's all that I am.
Yeah. So in the fact that you have no doubt in the knowing and being known, what's next as far as you're concerned? Obviously, as the passages go, it is appointed for every man once to die, and then the judgment. And obviously, that's from a biblical phrase. Of course, I then say, tell that to Lazarus, would you please?
And a couple of others too.
And a couple of
yeah, he wasn't alone. He was alone in his time period,
yeah.
But he wasn't alone.
What is the? And of course, this then brings up a lot of more mental games. Like, okay, so what is death? You say, and even your partner says, you were dead. Well, what's the definition? What's the definition of death?
Well, when you eat of the tree of knowledge, you enter the duality, and that's the suffering here is because we're not in the perfection of oneness. The duality here is simply because for it to exist, there has to be blessing and suffering here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way the whole systems work.
Right.
If you're a mouse and a cat, or a wolf and a cat,
mm-hmm.
That's the way it all goes. And I think of original goodness, the Eastern Orthodox perspective, the preceding the fall is the original preciousness that you spoke of.
Yeah.
That gives us our value, and that value is derived directly, that's a little v value, derived directly as an image reflection of the great V, the big V value, the divine one.
Mm.
It is,
to me, we struggle so much as human beings just to try to figure out who we are and where we are and where we fit in our social structure, let alone in the spiritual structure, I guess is the way I want to phrase it. And as much as it is helpful for some to help us in that quest, as you've already stated and quite eloquently, you got to go inside. There's no other way. No other human being can really help you. Your experience
right.
was internal, and you had it was profound, and it was life affirming, let alone life changing. And now there's no shaking you of that. And
no,
I remember in my conversations with Greg Braden when we were talking about his book, The Spontaneous Healing of Belief. He made the statement that one day we will no longer believe. He says, we will transition. We will evolve from believing to knowing.
You know when that's going to happen? I know when that's going to happen.
It's
going to happen every single time a person dies. The moment that they die, they transition into the place of knowing.
Mm.
So the evolution of humanity may or may not be biological, but it definitely is spiritual.
Yeah.
Anecdotally.
Yeah. But still, I remember another author, this goes back to the late 80s, early 90s. This was a Christian author. And he was discussing in his book or he was trying to lay out this premise that Christianity had been led down a primrose path. They'd been lied to. And so he began to do some search. It was very scholarly research, but it was profound for me because what he found as he began to define words and he began to put passages together and he began to do all this, and he'd read the Bible backwards and forwards a number of times.
Of course.
He came to the same conclusion that you did on an intellectual level, that the Christian experience is not external. It's all internal, including the rapture, including the return of the Christ, including all of those elements that are talked about that are made to sound as if they're literal physical events.
But they're only sounding as if they're literal physical events because of the rise of in the Enlightenment age, when the church became frightened of reason and science entered into the church, and it went two paths. One, the mainline churches that became austere. You can see it in their architecture of the straight lines and the white interiors of the clear glass windows, where reason and expository historical critical analysis is the tool set that we use to examine the scriptures. And then the other side was the loss of metaphorical language altogether to a calcification of literalism that made the whole thing, as you said, into a physical, permanent, concrete structure.
Yeah.
Missing the key, both of them often miss the key, which is metaphor.
It's been said that truth is only truth until it is written down.
Yeah, right.
I've always loved that phrase. So it's a sort of a paradox. Okay, I want to do some research and I need to find out some answers. And the only way to do that is to go into these things that have been written down.
Right, by other people in their own time period who were like, I don't really know the answer to this. I think I'll write this down.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's one of the problems I ran into constantly was, oh, why don't you, Richard, just go read the writings of the founding fathers of the faith. And some of them they would list off, and of course I'd never heard of them before, and I thought, well, wait a minute. First of all, who set these guys up as the arbiters of the faith? And second of all, if I've never heard of them, and I'm asking the same questions, does that put me at the same level as them? And so now I can write my own answers to these questions, you know, kind of thing.
Sort of yes and sort of no. I mean, those people, first of all, were held back.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. The Catholic Church not only kept the Bible away from everybody, they kept everything away from everybody.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then the Protestants come along, and the first thing they want to do is give the Bible out to everybody. But what they didn't do is go back and look at the history the Catholic Church was keeping out of the hands of everybody.
Yeah.
So the early church fathers helped form the theological foundations that the people were using to interpret the Bible they were reading.
Yeah. I love actually reading the apocryphal scriptures.
Me too.
So much more depth to them, and it makes, strangely enough, makes a whole lot more sense. And I remember, I asked somebody the question back then. Well, what's the criterion for determining what is and isn't canon? And of course, they told me this, you know, and I did some reading, I did some more research, and I found someone who was discussing this in their article, their essay, what have you. And they said that there was one book in the Old Testament that actually it was in it, but it shouldn't have been. It didn't quite fit with this litmus test for all six of the other 66 books of the Bible. And it was the Song of Solomon. Which is, in essence, if you want to really break it down, it's about sex.
It's an allegorical sex poem.
Sure.
About
how
God
does that
and this couple?
How did this get in there? You know.
I don't know, but it's my favorite to use in weddings. I love reading it in weddings.
Oh yeah. Oh, and it's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. But this was part of where I was coming from intellectually, trying to make sense of all of these different. And all of these different teachings and positions that people in different sects of Christianity, that's the word I use, where they were coming from that, again, didn't make logical sense to me. And, I just
– hard to deny that that's an allegorical book. So people who don't like sex, who don't like public sex, and I think of the Congregationalists and the Puritans and the Pilgrims back in the 19th. Anyway, so
yeah,
so that allegorical book about sex was kind of like, it functions as a key to remind people who didn't like to dance because it was too close together that either sex is real or they have to be forced into thinking of it as an allegory when they're literalists.
Yeah.
So you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. Well, the other aspect too is that if we're all connected, it doesn't matter how close we get because we're all connected.
we are all connected in ways that people have no idea.
Exactly.
It's invisible. It's invisible to the human eye as long as we're here veiled.
Yeah. And the process of transitioning, I heard once described as basically, you're just taking off a big overcoat. That's all. But then when you describe having to be put back into that overcoat, it's like, I don't know that I like that. I don't think I want to have that happen, you know. But it's, again.
It was a mistake.
I'm sorry?
It was a mistake. It was a mistake. I mean, from the life I've lived since then, my kids would say that it wasn't a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew in the moment that I got shoved back in that I shouldn't have come back.
Mm. But you've never tried going back since.
No, because I don't belong to myself. I've worked with a lot of suicidal people. Lots of my friends have committed suicide, and mm-hmm. I, as a pastor, you're up in the front lines with that kind of stuff. I've thought about it a lot.
Now I'm curious.
But I do. I think about it still, but I learned on the other side that my body doesn't even belong to me. My soul didn't even belong to me.
Mm-hmm.
My soul didn't belong to me. I was created. I was made by the Creator. I'm not self-made.
Yeah.
That didn't make me.
Yeah.
And not only did I not make my soul, I so much less did not make my body.
Yeah. That's why when
I inhabit.
That's why when I share with people this next piece, I do it very carefully because I try to be respectful of where they might be coming from because I may not mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. and I tell them that from the spiritual perspective, privacy, freedom, and liberty—these three in particular—they're all an illusion. They're all an illusion. They don't exist. There is no such thing as any of this. A, because we're all connected. Okay? B, because of the fact that we're all connected. And as you've described, you're known. Everything about you is known.
And you too.
And me too. So, I joke with people. I said, look, if the NSA wants to follow me around, I am flattered that they find my life that interesting that I need to be followed around. That's number one. Number two is because I am known completely, utterly, and in totality, what difference does it make if 7.5 billion other people know and most of them don't care?
And not only that, you get to leave.
Yeah.
You get to leave here. And when that door closes behind you, none of that matters at all.
Yeah.
At all does it matter.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter zero. So for all the struggles and the suffering that we have here, or being known on the internet as you could look me up. I'm sure you did.
I got you.
Of course you would. I cyber stalking, my daughter calls it. And I use it all the time. Of course I looked you up too, Richard.
Uh-oh.
Creepers.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you know.
My rap sheet. It's very short.
And a rap.
Yes, thank you so much. very good.
Jeepers.
It's one of those things that, people get so wound up in, especially in this day and age with the technology we have. And I got on the computer and I got on the internet back in 1994. And because I had enough of an understanding of what it was, the moment I went on the internet, I knew... This was one of those things that I absolutely knew that I had no privacy. Give it up, people. If you have any connectivity to the rest of the world through that medium we call the internet, you have no privacy. It's gone. And you need to accept that fact, that reality. Who
cares?
Try to
control it.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah. Who cares if people know? And because I share a hell of a lot on these programs about myself. Yeah, I'm dealing
with. Oh, yeah, me too.
I got high blood pressure. Sure, I do. I have glaucoma and lost vision in my left eye. Okay. And I got these little rashes here and there. And let's not go too far into this because that's TMI, TMI, TMI. But you see where I'm going with this is that, and as you've already gone there, I don't know the way you know, but I know I have that awareness that I am known in totality, can never be taken away. I am connected with all other souls in the universe. Ergo, they also, should they have the mind to care, know also, there's no place to hide. And eventually, I hope we all can come to the place where we don't have to anymore. Because then you maintain that duality of light and dark. If you're hiding, where are you hiding? In the shadows.
There's no hiding when you die.
Yeah.
There's only nakedness.
Yeah. And personally, I've had some experiences where that hasn't been so bad.
Yes. It's even more naked than that.
That's right. Hey, let me ask you a quick question before we wrap up the program here. In regards to your experiences with and working with folks who are suicidal, and as you say, you've lost many to that. And I knew of a group in Phoenix when I lived there called Suiciders Anonymous. It was a very interesting energy that I experienced when I was around these folks who, just like the other anonymous groups, you know, they have the 12 steps and so forth, and they have the sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
I am curious, though. I'm sure there have been those who have attempted. They actually did die, but they came back. Can you tell us a little bit about
I only know what I've read.
Okay.
Certainly not their experience, but the few that I've read, some people go to hell and they suffer whatever that hell is. It's, you know, some fire, some pain, some suffering, all metaphor anyway. There's no light. You know, we call God light, but there's no photons over there. And then they come back and they change their lives. I mean, there's this famous fella on, you can look him up, hell, N-E-D, near-death experience, hell. Christian, I think I saw him on like the 700 Club or something like that, one of those shows. He had a hard time. I know someone else who committed suicide, and I met him because I was caring for his mother. His mother was in a hospital bed, and I was a pastor, and the first time she came, I came to her, she was so depressed. Her kid had died a year before, and she was sick in bed at the hospital, not well at all. And I visited her for a couple, 3 weeks. And then the third time I visited her on a Thursday, she said, I had a dream. I've been waiting for you to come in. I had a dream last night. My son, let's call him Andy, came to me in a dream, and only was unlike any other dream. And he communicated to me directly without words. And I could see that he was happy and joyous. And there was like a light about him. And he said, I'm all right, Mom. I'm okay. Mm. So, I mean, I think that God is ultimately love, and I know that God is love. Mm. I don't think that. I know God is love, and God, I didn't deserve to be forgiven, but I was.
Yeah. Well, and we all do, and we need to start the process of accepting that, because that frees us up to move forward, to live out our life's purpose, and to help others along their path. And we thank you for sharing so much time with us here on the program. It's been fantastic. And before I let you go, I want to, first of all, extend to you the invitation. Should you find yourself out here in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
Oh, thank you. That'd be great. Thanks.
And I have also a reminder to our listeners, the website for you to go to find out more about Peter. We will encourage you to investigate and research and do whatever you need to do. Peter Panagor, peterpanagor.com is the website. That is one place where you can find out about a lot of the various books that he has written. And we encourage you. You also have a book of poetry, The Wet Dark of February. And we encourage you to go to his website. You can get this stuff on Amazon and all different places. And, of course, as you already know, the book is of Heaven is Beautiful is also an audiobook, which I think is fantastic. And I have to say that even though you're not the one reading reading it, which I think the gentleman, the narrator who did read it, great job. You, I think, should be doing the reading of that book. So maybe think about that as well. And again, we thank you so much for your time. I have three final questions for you before we wrap up the program. And again, thank you for sharing with us here on Tell Me Your Story. First question is, who is Peter Panagor?
I belong to God. That's my answer.
All right. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I hope to bring hope and encouragement to the suffering before they transition to fear not, and to trust in love, and to treat each other with love, and to live love as much as we can in this difficult and beautiful world.
And what is your life's purpose?
To live love till I die.
Peter Panagor, thank you again for sharing with us Heaven is Beautiful, How Dying Taught Me That Death is Just the Beginning. We again thank you and look forward to talking with you again in the not-too-distant future.
Good to meet you, Richard. Thank you, everybody. I appreciate you having me on. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.